I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Dottie Shore. May the meditation of my heart and the words of my lips always be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord. May my words be acceptable in your sight this morning. I'm very emotional. This one over here cracks me up. She's the best thing that ever happened to me. Well, they say we're highly emotional, easily upset, and very sensitive. So after a moment's hesitation while I cry, then I'll start to talk, okay? It's a double pleasure for me to be in Las Vegas to speak at this beautiful roundup. Because, you see, I am a native Nevadan. I was born and raised in Reno. And this is the first time I've been privileged to speak in my home state. For that, I'm deeply grateful. Thank you very much for having me here. I wonder why it is that my hands are wet and my mouth is dry when it should be the other way around. I do not believe that our program has a spiritual side. I think this is a spiritual program. And if you look at our 12 steps, you'll see that after the very first step, you pick up God as a partner. And it is spiritual. And if that word bothers you, look in your dictionary and see that spiritual means an honest and upright way of life. And we are not bad people who drink. We are people who drink and do some bad things. But I think the reason we drank, and please remember, dear love, the things I say from this podium are my own interpretation of what's been taught to me. I used to say these are my own ideas, but my own ideas got me drunk, so I don't talk about my own ideas anymore. This is what it seems like to me. And I fully believe that without a God of my understanding, that I cannot obtain and maintain sobriety. Let's talk about a few of the things that our beloved AA book says. And by the way, I hope you know that this book was taken from the Bible. All the good spiritual concepts of the world are put into this book. With no thou shalt not, but we suggest. And I think that's why you and I can make it on this program. You tell me I shouldn't do anything, and you better clear the room, because I'm going to do it. The first thing that hits my mind is the fact that no human power can relieve my alcoholism, but that God can and will if sought. And oh, what a dilemma when you come into this program with a God that you threw out with the church. I threw the baby out with the bathwater. I could have nothing to do with him. I was terrorized. He was going to grab me by the hair one day and put me in a pit and burn me forever and ever. For 19 years, I walked the face of this earth like a total lost soul. And I thank God this morning for alcohol. I'm quite sure if I hadn't had a sedative called alcohol to take that pain away, that I would have destroyed myself with a gun or something long before then. But AA, or alcohol, was my medicine. And so if no human power can relieve my alcoholism, but God can and will have sought, I'm quite sure someone else must have sought him for me. And if there are people in this room who do not have a God of your understanding, you better believe that when I go to bed tonight, I will seek him for you. And I think we're all here by the prayers of someone else, certainly not by ours, because ours were, oh God, get me out of this mess and I won't drink again. Or please give me, or where are you, or why me? I'm quite sure those prayers weren't answered. And so when those prayers weren't answered, we ended up copping out and saying there is no God. And that's a hard thing to live with. Now my AA book tells me that lack of power is my dilemma. All the time I thought booze was my problem. Now, what kind of power do we lack? Do we lack intellectual power? Physical power? No. Lack of power is our dilemma. And people say to me when they're new, I don't buy that higher power. I have no higher power. And I'll say, oh, don't you? You had booze as your higher power or drugs, and you played the tune and you did the dance. And all I ask you to do is to take your life out of a destructive power and find a power greater than yourself that I happen to choose and love to call God. The book goes on to say, there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And so you see, this is not a spiritual part of our program. Everything in the program is spiritual. and I'm grateful. Because I ran out of power, I ran out of guts, I ran out of willpower, I ran out of strength, I ran out of everything. And I think it's a shame, but it seems like only when we come to the place where we run out of everything can we then surrender to win. I'm glad that I had to finally be forced to surrender. You know, there's a story in the scriptures that I love, and it's about Jeremiah. The Lord was trying to teach him that he had to correct things in himself, and so he told him to go down to a potter's shack and observe. So Jeremiah went down to the potter's shack, and he saw this potter with some clay on a wheel, and it was just a soft lump of clay, and the potter started to turn the wheel, and he was forming a beautiful vessel. But halfway through, he stopped the wheel, and he took it off, and he broke it, and he kneaded it, and he made it pliable. And then he put it back on the wheel, and Jeremiah said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, there was a flaw in it, and I had to break it and knead it and make it pliable so that I could make the vessel out of it that I wanted." And when he put it back on the wheel again and started making it, he made a beautiful vessel. And I don't know how you feel, but I think each one of us was a wonderful, beautiful piece of clay at one time. And the potter started to mold us and make a beautiful vessel out of us, and somewhere along the line we picked up a flaw. And so he took me, I don't know about you, off that wheel, and he broke me, and he kneaded me, and he made me pliable. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God, he put me back on the wheel, and I was pliable. And then he started to make the vessel that I hope you'll see today. And he started filling it with love and compassion and understanding. Most of all, he filled it with himself. And my prayer has become one that comes from an old song. Have thine own way, Lord. Have thine own way. You are the potter. I am the clay. And as long as I remain pliable, as long as I don't get what I call seniority syndrome, which is a big killer, as long as you don't start to believe all the wonderful things people say about you, you know, you're going to be pliable. God prevent me from ever getting to the place where I think I am somebody. Because you see, by myself, I am nothing. But I can do all things through God and this AA program and your love. I think the most wonderful thing outside of the gift of sobriety that Alcoholics Anonymous and you people this morning have given to me is what I call agape love. Now that's God's love. Agape love means unconditional love. Not as I should be, not as I will be, not as I can be, but totally accepting me as I am. And you people out there have that wonderful gift called agape love. And I think that was the thing that saved my life. When I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was in February of 1950, almost 30 years ago. Now, you've got to know they caught me and put shoes on me and threw me in here as a baby, don't you? As I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on February 8, 1950, I weighed 82 pounds. I was suffering from malnutrition. My mouth was split and bleeding at the corners. I had bumps in my neck. They called vitamin deficiency bumps. I looked about 65 years old, and I was totally insane. I sat in the second row with my sponsor. And a man got up that night, and he spoke, and he talked about fifth a day, sanitariums, jails, 86s, 502s, convulsions, losing the family, and I'm sitting there terrorized thinking, my God, I scared myself into this thing. Well, maybe I'm only a little alcoholic. Someone said, you can't be a little pregnant and you can't be a little alcoholic. But the trap I fell into, dear ones, was to try to identify with the drinking pattern, and it was to cause me grave problems. This morning, I ask you not to try to identify with my drinking pattern, but I do pray you identify with my thinking pattern. It's the stinking thinking, at least the drinking, you know that. And so I was impressed with these people, and the greatest impression is when they didn't say, my God, put some weight on, tone your makeup down, how much money do you have, what kind of a car do you drive? They just said, if you're an alcoholic, you're in the right place, and they put their warm arms around me, and they literally loved me to death. They accepted me totally as I was for the first time in my life. I had never been accepted by God, by man, or by myself until that very moment. As I got ready to leave the meeting that day, they said, action is a magic word. I thought they said activity. I almost killed myself. Now, another thing happened that first meeting. They had a birthday cake celebration. And I was raised in a family of two other sisters, and my older sister, 2 years older than I was highly talented. Very talented, multi-talented. She was a radio singer, a junior champion skier, and a model. And no, I am not Dinah Shore's sister. My sister's name was Evelyn. She was totally adored by my mother. She was dressed like a princess. I had a baby sister come along when I was 9 years old, and by her very babyness, she was treated right, and I was dressed like Cinderella. I wore secondhand clothes and walked with shoes with holes in it that every morning I'd have to cut cardboard out. My poor, sick, neurotic mother was incapable of loving more than one person at a time. And so I had sat in audiences for many years and watched my sister either sing or get a cup for skiing or model. And that night, in my sick little mind, I'm sitting down here in the front row, and North Hollywood has a platform. And I thought, all I have to do is not drink for a year, and I'll be up there, and you'll be down there looking at me, and it'll be my big night. And so I know now, I have 20/20 vision hindsight, looking back, that's exactly what I did. I went dry. Now, I have a kind of a gift of gab, I suppose you'd call it. I fell in love with my voice at a very early age, and the love affair is still going on. And so in 1950, there were very few women who would speak. And when they found out I could talk, they put me on the circuit when I was 49 days dry. And they sent me to Bakersfield and San Diego and any place in between. My sponsor was a book woman, and for that I'm deeply grateful. And we'd go to meetings, participation meetings, or closed women's meetings, and she'd always quote from the book. On page 72, it says thus and so. On page 42, it says something else. I've been granted a gift from God called a photographic memory. And I used to go home and immediately memorize every page she talked about. And I started talking. Now, my drunk log is so boring that it puts me to sleep, so I'm not going to give it to you. It was a gutless housewife, pull the window shade down, hide the bottle, totally insane drinking. And that's not very impressive, you know, when you've got all these multitude of people to speak to. So I would take a little bit of everybody's pitch. If I heard somebody say something was funny, it was automatically mine. You know, I really ended up having one hell of a pitch before I was through. It was really fantastic. I had more AA babies at North Hollywood than anybody else. And I took full credit for everybody that got sober. The ones who got drunk, I didn't even know them. I had one girl that used to keep getting drunk on me all the time. She'd call North Hollywood and ask to have someone sent out. And they say, do you have a sponsor? And she'd say, yes, Dottie Shore. I got in my car and went over and threatened to beat the hell out of her if she ever told anybody I was your sponsor. I wasn't going to have any failures on this thing. Good heavens, no. Well, I loved every minute of it. And the year went by on the wings. I thought I didn't have an obsession. My sponsor says, you haven't had an obsession to drink since you got here. And I said, no. Now, I thought the obsession was to keep me out of a liquor store with my hand off a glass. I didn't know it was a little voice back here, that devilish little voice that says, you're not like those people. You didn't drink that much that long or do those things. But they need you. Oh, my God. They really need you. You're such a wonderful speaker and such a wonderful sponsor and, you know, that you just add to this group. But I thought, well, maybe one day when I get my thinking straightened around, maybe I can have a drink. Now, chapter 3 puts it better than I can. The great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that somehow, someday, some way, we're going to control and enjoy this. The delusion is astonishing. Many will pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. When I came to you in 1950, I was in hallucinations and blackouts. I was in terror. I was sure that I had people with their hands up like this looking in the window. And I went around and pulled the window shades down and took a drink and went around and pulled them back up. I was the tartest drunk that came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I swear. And I had blackouts. And I didn't know what a blackout was until you told me. I thought, geez, I'm just thinking too deeply. 4 hours go by and I don't know where I am. Oh, my. I believe that we are split personalities. I think we're egocentrics with inferiority complexes. And I think we're split right down the middle. And I think this side of my personality says, no one will ever know about me. I'll take it to the grave with me. You ever heard that expression? If they find out what I'm really like, they'll kick me out. I'll never let anybody really know what I'm like. Besides, I am kind of dumb and kind of stupid. But, oh, this side of my personality says you're so gorgeous. Oh, such a sponsor, and what a speaker. Man. So the old pendulum swings back and forth, you get totally thrown off balance. When I came to you, I was stuck over here on my inferiority side. By the way, inferiority is ego turned in on yourself, you know. It reminds me of the story of Mrs. Jones who went to the psychiatrist. And the doctor said, Mrs. Jones, what do you suppose your problem is? And she said, well, doctor, I have a terrible inferiority complex. He thought for a minute and he said, Mrs. Jones, you don't have an inferiority complex. You are inferior. I had rendered myself totally incapable of arranging my hair or buying a dress by myself or arranging furniture or making the simplest decision, which I know today is a cop-out. If I don't make the decisions, then my husband does, and it's wrong, it's his fault. But I leaned so heavily that I had no strength of my own. And so being stuck on this side of my personality, as I started to get a little sober or dry, I would say, because I was not sober. There's a difference between being dry and sober. But as the alcohol left my system, it started to get into a space it should have gotten about here. But it flew to the egocentric side of my personality and got stuck over there. And let me share with you, ego will get you drunker than the first drink. Dr. Thiebaud in AA Comes of Age talks about the ego. So we have to have ego deflation at depth. Now the ego doesn't know it's supposed to be deflated. We go about our business, and right behind us, like a giant shadow, this ego grows up. And if you don't keep your head over your shoulder, kind of watching for it, it'll smash you down every time. And I believe that the thing that was to force me to drink again was the obsession never left, and my ego took over. And when I pursued this to the gates of insanity, which is blackouts and hallucinations, the first kind of brain damage, I'm sad to tell you that I had to pursue this to the gates of death. For me, I had to find out that it's not how much you drink, how long you drink, what brand or with whom that constitutes alcoholism. It's can you guarantee your behavior when you take the first drink? I can today. I couldn't then. I thought, sure, I'll get drunk and I'll come back. The door to AA swings both ways. But the reason I think that was precipitating this is that I got so resentful. Now, when you patted me on the back and told me how wonderful I was and I agreed with you, everything was going great. And the first year birthday came. My God, I had rehearsed my acceptance speech for 6 months. It was magnificent. You should have heard it. I got more presents than I'd ever gotten in a needle birthday. Patted me on the back again and told me how wonderful I was, and again I agreed. My two children and my husband sat in the front row, and I guess I thought I'd graduated. I was absolutely on cloud 199. Now, the book tells me that we are used to three things. Excitement, anxiety, and depression. A peace of mind and a quiet heart we know nothing of. And I was in a perpetual state of excitement for a year. You can get as hung over with that as you can booze. And so when that first birthday ended, I had what is known as the postnatal blues set in. I have now to go another year for my big night. And I'm tired. I had gone to work 3 months after I got sober. I had two teenage daughters, a husband, an apartment, and went out practically every night. And so I sat back and thought, I'm an old timer now. I got a year. I'll just sit back and let some of the newcomers take over. So I broke my meeting pattern first. I went on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Tuesday night came along and it was a good television program or Academy Awards, or it was raining, or it was hot, or it was cold, or whatever. I would say to myself, I'll go Thursday. Now, when I went in there on Thursday night after not having been there for the previous week, and don't forget I was an every night member, nobody rushed the door and asked me where the hell I'd been, and they're staying sober without me. And I'm unhappy. I'm resentful. My sponsor says, you have a resentment, and you better take care of it. And I said, I do not have a resentment. I have justifiable anger. So this went on, and it got worse, and it got worse. And many things went on now. I went to a little town called Azusa. Driving rainstorm, the windshield wiper wouldn't carry the rain away. And I got into a large room, and there was two old people sitting there. By the time the meeting started, there were six old people sitting there. And I'm hardly insulted, they asked the great Dottie Shore to come all that way in the driving rain to speak to six old people. So when they started asking me to speak, I'd screen the group and ask them how big it was. It was a big group I went, it was a small group I sent one of my babies. Now, I didn't know this was going on. Then I did what I think is the most unforgivable thing that you and I, who have been granted this pearl of great price called sobriety, can do. I started turning down 12-step calls. Now, in my own defense, I didn't let them go. But I'm too big and old, I'm an old-timer to make calls on those new drunks, so I'd send my people. Let's talk about the pearl of great price that we have. You've been sober since you walked through those doors this morning. You have been granted, by God, a pearl of great price. If I had a pearl that was as big as my thumbnail, I would put it in a safety deposit box and have it heavily insured. And yet if I lost it, I really would have lost nothing. Now, a pearl is formed in the shell of an oyster. And the shell on the outside gets a scratch or a wound, and some sand is let in there. And by pain and irritation, the oyster will throw out some kind of like a saliva substance that forms a pearl. It is a pearl of great price, caused by pain and irritation. And today, if we have sobriety, it is our pearl of great price, caused by pain and irritation. No one really in the world has suffered the pain that you and I have. You say, oh, that's not true. The cancer patient suffers worse than we do. No, I don't believe so. I'm not minimizing cancer pain. But when you have the kind of pain that you and I live through, this is indescribable. That is the kind of pain that is something the world doesn't understand. Only a person who is addicted can understand the kind of pain. Heard a man say not too long ago that after he got to AA, he never realized for years he'd walked with a belly full of ground glass and his brain hemorrhaging. And if that sounds dramatic, that's exactly the way I felt. My belly was full of ground glass. My brain was hemorrhaging and screaming at all times. And to think that I had to go through that in order to find this, it was a very little price to pay. For what I have today, dear ones, it's a little price to pay. I would not like to have to go through it again, but I'm grateful that it took what it took to get me here. Well, on June the 10th, 1951, I went to a meeting, and it was a beginner's meeting. About 15 people raised their hand, and the leader said, you are the most important people in the room. And I thought, like hell they are. What are they doing around this place? My, how it's changed since I first got here. I thought, you know, you lose those new drinks, you haven't lost too much. But now an old-timer like me, you've really, you know, you're going to have a loss in there. My sponsor wouldn't give me 3 hours of undivided attention on the phone. She had new babies, and I hated her, too. So on the way home, that meeting that night, I split. I always liked the meeting after the meeting before the meeting during the meeting, and I left. And on the way home, my little sick mind says, I know what I'll do. I'll fix those people, those ungrateful SOBs. They took me and squeezed me dry like a lemon, and they threw me away. So I'll punish them. I'll get drunk, and then they'll be sorry. It's hard today, thank God, for me to believe that I'm telling you about me. I have come to believe that this is somebody I knew a great deal about, somebody I knew and was acquainted with, but thank God I don't feel like it's within me anymore. So my little fantasy took over, and I thought, well, I know I'm going to get drunk, and I'm going to get sick. But the guy says I always unswallowed a lot, so that wasn't going to be anything new. I would see my husband coming home. Now, I'm not hiding the bottle this time. I'm going to put it on the coffee table, I'm going to put my feet up there, and I'm going to tell him to go plumb to hell if he doesn't like it. That I can see him in terror going to the phone, calling the North Hollywood Clubhouse and saying, what have you people done to her? And they're saying, what did we do? And he's telling them I'm drinking, and they are so upset. They get in a caravan of cars and come over to my house. they make amends and I forgive them. Pitiful, really pitiful. They take me back to North Hollywood and I'm the brand newcomer and they're patting me on the back and telling me how wonderful I was and everything's fine. Now, I memorized the steps. I taught them. I preached them. I recited them. I did everything with the steps but work them. You want to know about AA? Just ask me. If you don't, I'm going to tell you about it anyhow. Knew it all. Well, I went home. Got up the next morning. Cleaned myself up, put my makeup on, my earrings, cleaned my house. I wasn't going to have them call them slob, you understand. My mother used to say, put on clean underwear in case anything happens, so I put on clean underwear. And I walked to the liquor store and I bought the same half pint. I didn't drive because I didn't know I was driving in blackouts. You scared me there. I heard all the things I shouldn't have heard and didn't hear anything I should hear. So I walked to the liquor store, came home. Now I have 16 months and 3 days of sobriety. I will tell you today, I had 16 months and 3 days of being physically dry from alcohol. My favorite hiding place, and you have to find hiding places when you're married to a sneaky Pete non-alcoholic, you know. They get in there and they just have they have x-ray eyes, honest to God. They can find bottles that you thought sure you'd hidden. For the last 2.5 years of my drinking, I was not a cocktail, pretty glass type of an alcoholic. I drank out of a vinegar bottle for 2.5 years. And the reason I did is because vinegar and bourbon are the same color. And so I poured the vinegar out of the bottle and poured the whiskey and I put it right up in front of the cupboard. And this non-alcoholic would come home and I'd be a little drunky poo. And he'd start looking and he'd shove that vinegar bottle back and forth and I'd stand behind, I'm laughing like hell, never found my bottle. But now, 16 months and 3 days later, it's going to be different, right? Wrong. I went home, took the vinegar bottle down. I don't care who sees me drink now, but this is it. Poured the vinegar out, poured the whiskey in the vinegar bottle, and took my first drink out of the vinegar bottle. Now, when that whiskey burned my throat, and please listen, that was the first conscious thought I had that I had drank, and I thought, my God, what have I done? There goes 16 months of sobriety shot to hell. I had my hands on the door jams, and I'm totally terrorized. And I'm waiting, and nothing happened. And I'm thinking, ha! Knew all along I wasn't like those drunks over at North Hollywood. I went out in the kitchen to have what I thought was going to be my second drink. What I tell you now, dear ones, is told me by my husband and my sponsor. My husband's an outside salesman. And he knew I was squirreled up, and there's no Al-Anon in those days. So he broke off the territory to come home to find out what was going on. And he heard me screaming a half a block before I got to the house. And when he came in the house, I was on the floor, beating my hands and my heels on the floor till I almost broke the bones in my feet. I had dry heaves, so I broke a blood vessel into my esophagus. I'm bleeding from the nose and the mouth. There is no whites left in my eyes. They're just red slits. He tried to get me up off the floor. I went totally limp. Now, in absolute terror, he didn't take the car. He remembered there was a medical center 2 blocks from where we lived. So he tore out of the house and ran the 2 blocks. And there were 7 doors along the sidewalk. Medical suite. Came to the first one available, and the office was full of people. He crashed past the receptionist, went into the doctor's examining room, grabbed the doctor, and said something like, "My wife's been sober 16 months, and she's drinking. I think she's dying. Will you come?" Now, the very first of many miracles, my higher power, whom I choose and love to call God, was to step into my life. Because that doctor didn't say a word. He didn't say, "Get the rescue squad. My God, another drunk. You've hospitalization. Who recommended you?" If he'd have stopped to say any of those things, it would be a different story. He picked up his bag and ran to my house with my husband. When he got there, he put the stethoscope on my chest. He turned to my husband and he said, "All vital signs are gone. No heartbeat, no pulse, no respiration." On June 11, 1951, Dottie Shore died of a narcotic called alcohol. And if that sounds dramatic, it is. My husband went hysterical. My doctor took, he said, I'll try one last thing. He took a needle. My husband said, looked a foot long, shot me directly into the chest cavity, and started artificial resuscitation. And again, by the grace of God, I started breathing. Now let's take it back. Suppose an hour had been 2 seconds late coming home. The doctor hesitated 3. They could have brought my heart back beating, but my brain would have been gone. Sometimes I think maybe they overestimated the time. You know, maybe that's what's wrong. At least it gives me a cop-out, doesn't it? The total amount of alcohol I had that morning, dear ones, was 3 straight shots of whiskey. On 3 straight shots of whiskey, it almost took my life. It went into my bloodstream, repressed my respiratory tract, and I OD'd on a drug called alcohol. That is hard to believe, and for a long time that record has stood. 3 drinks, and you almost die. But nobody has ever a story that isn't topped. About 4 or 5 years ago, I was working with a girl that really was a very beautiful, beautiful human being. She was an ex-ice volleys girl, totally emotionally crippled. She came to the program, she kept drinking, and for some reason or other, I never let her go. I just listened to her on the phone. I think in my heart of hearts, I knew this was one who could not make the program. She came into the program, she met some guy, she got pregnant, the guy split, and she was going to have this baby. Many days I used to pray for the wisdom, should I have this child taken from her because she was drinking. Well, then she went on a period of sobriety, dryness. Didn't drink, but she became a recluse. And I called her and talked to her, and she'd call and talk to me, and the time went on about 4 years after she had this child, 4 to 5 years. And one day I called her and she didn't answer. And I called her at noon, she didn't answer. I called her in the afternoon and at night and the next morning, and I'm frightened because she was totally recluse by this time. And so I took another girl with me and I went over to the manager and I said, would you please open the door? There's something wrong in there. Oh, this really gets to me. She'd been dead for 5 days, with a little 5-year-old child locked in the apartment with her. And when the autopsy was performed, she had 2 straight shots of booze in her, and that's all. She was not as fortunate as I or blessed. If someone had found her, they could have saved her. 2 ounces of alcohol and death. Can you imagine that little child? Pray for that child every night, locked up in the room with that drunken mother, dead. 5-year-old child, couldn't get out. Oh, my God, what we do to our people. What we do to our people. But I know that my higher power has forgiven me for anything I have ever done. I have unconditional forgiveness, thank God. So at any rate, I was sedated all night long after this drunk, and I had to go back to the doctor in a couple of days. But before that happened, there's something very important. My husband didn't let the children in the room until the next morning. Now, they're 15 and 12. Standing at the foot of my bed, and my youngest daughter had a strange phenomenon, like a white ring of chalk drawn around her mouth every time she got frightened, and here's that look again. I hadn't seen this look for 16 months, and all of these red slits of eyes and my face so swelled. My oldest daughter said, Mother, we want you to do us a favor, and I thought it was to be the same, please don't drink. I said, anything if you won't be mad. And she brought off behind her book, the Alcoholics Anonymous, behind her back, the Alcoholics Anonymous book, and read to me the preamble and the 12 steps. I didn't hear any more of them. See, I knew them. And when you guys read them at every meeting, I think, oh, God, I guess it's for those dinglings they have to keep reading this thing over. I never listened. And that morning, I didn't hear any more of them, with the exception of this sentence. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. And it was like it was a phonograph needle stuck in a record, and all day long, that's all I was to hear. When I got out of that bed, I knew I hadn't had a little slip. Doesn't say rarely have we seen a person have a little slip. Rarely have we seen a person have a little research to do. It says fail. See, I know today that I failed a God-given program called Alcoholics Anonymous. It did not and cannot, will not and cannot fail us. It is absolutely divinely inspired. I believe that God looked down on you and I one day, as he looked down on people through all generations, and he picked a person to give a message to, Moses and Isaiah and Jeremiah and Paul and Peter and Mark and Luke, all the rest of them. And Yankee looked down on you and I one day and he says, you know, they don't understand my people. They call them highly emotional, easily upset and sensitive. That's what they are, and they call them drunks and luscious and no good. So I'm going to find a man, and I'm going to whisper a message into his ear. And surely to God, he picked Bill Wilson as a modern-day prophet. And on top of that came Dr. Bob. And then I think one day he looked down on the compulsive overeater who suffered from as grave a disease as you and I do. Allergic to carbohydrates and sugars that set them going as the first drink sets us. He said, they don't understand my people. They call them fatties and gluttons. But they're highly emotional, easily upset and sensitive. And he whispered to another person in the generation and brought the program of Compulsive Overeaters Anonymous into existence. And from that followed Emotional Health Anonymous, EHA, and GA, and all the rest of the programs. See, we all have emotionally induced illnesses. And thank God they don't have to have 15 different programs. One will do it. And so I think this program is divinely inspired and protected. Can't you imagine just in this room 1,200 alcoholics trying to change the book? Man, I think there's over 1 million or so. Can you imagine how that thing would have been chopped up, cut up, burned up, and lost long before now? God even protected the AA program from alcoholics. He really did. Praise God. Well, I went to the doctor a couple days later, and he took me by the shoulders, and he shook me, and he said, you listen, girl. You see how long ago that was when he called me girl. He said, if you drink again, you will die. I've never examined anyone more dead than you. And my first thought was, oh, my God, why didn't he just let me go? I had my perfect out. See, I don't like the world. I never have liked it. I've never been one to fit in there. And the reason is because, basically, I've been a spiritual being, and I'm a stranger in that land out there, and so are you. We come in here and we work a spiritual program and we feel the love of God and we feel at home. Don't you know that's what it is? And so I've always been a stranger or a pilgrim out there. And you know something? I'm glad today that I am. I almost killed myself trying to be like those people. I'm glad I'm like you. I'm glad I have a place to go where I'm totally accepted, where I'm at one with you and my God. Oh, this program is so magical, so miraculous, so fantastic that the words don't, we can't give you the words to tell you what this thing's like. Well, the next thought on top of this was there must be something God wants me to do. And so I committed myself that morning, 2 days out of my last drunk, that I would never be too tired nor too busy to answer a call for anyone. The reason I said anyone is because I worked in pharmacy for some 23 years and I'd waited on the migraine headache people who are hooked on drugs, the ulcer patients who have 3/4 of their stomach removed, and high blood pressure, and all these diseases are emotionally induced and they don't have any answer. And that thing you see over there, when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want to be there. And so I used to pitch to these people across the counter. And they'd say, oh, you have such a wonderful philosophy. What church do you go to? And I'd say, well, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. And they'd go, oh, well, fine. Nice talking to you. And away they go. So about 9, almost 10 years ago, I formed a group in our area. And I called a step study meeting for emotionally induced illnesses. And in there I have migraine headache people and spastic colitis and ulcers and arthritis and rheumatism. High blood pressure, alcoholics, overeaters, all the emotionally induced illnesses. And do you know something? This program works. Do you know it does? It works for anyone who wants to apply it. And when I said anyone, I didn't know there was going to be an OA in existence one day or an EHA. But I'm so glad that when anybody, any place needs help, then my hand will always be out. And I won't say, well, if you're not an alcoholic, I don't understand you. Because I understand you if you're emotionally ill. Because I'm emotionally ill. And my book says there are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders that many of them recover if they have the capacity to be honest. And somewhere along the line, God granted me the gift of honesty where I had to grasp and develop it because I was never honest. But I grasped and developed a manner of living which demanded rigorous honesty and I became more totally a human being than I'd ever been before. I went back to the meetings. I had to not talk, not sponsor. I had to sit down, shut up, and listen and save my life. And that's exactly what I did. They'd tell me to do things, and I would think to myself, I don't like that. If I tell my sponsor I didn't like it, she'd say, you don't like that, Dottie? And I'd say, no. And she'd say, do it. If you're so damn smart, what are you doing here? And I started to be teachable, and that was, again, a gift of God. Now, the days became weeks, and the weeks became months, and the months became years, one day at a time. And by the grace of God and your love, your unconditional love and acceptance of Dottie Shore, I'm a little over 28 years and 5 months sober. You've got to know this is a miracle. You've got to know it. Let's give it to him. You did that for God, you know. Because if a human power could relieve alcoholism, I'd check out all the newcomers and I'd give you a little bit. I'd love to, but you wouldn't like it if it was given to you. We love things that we earn. And when we take the inventory, we dig into the past. We're so afraid of it, we think it's Pandora's box and it's going to destroy us. But instead of that, it's freedom. We seek the truth, and the truth will make us free. Had I sought the fourth step and found out in an inventory what my deeper-seated problem was. See, alcoholism is only a symptom of a deeper-seated problem if you can put that cork in the bottle like I did and be still totally miserable. If you're sober and you're miserable, you better hire yourself into a sponsor and you better start doing some inventory. You better find out why you're still torn up. Because if you don't find out your deeper-seated problem, may I warn you, you'll compulsively overeat. You'll start drugging or smoking funny cigarettes, or you'll start gambling, or the best one yet, you'll start hopping in and out of bed with somebody thinking, there's what's going to be. I believe we're wounded people right here. And oh my God, I put so many dirty bandages on that wound. I put sex and marriage and divorce and kids and money and property and prestige and cars and houses. And every time I put something on there, it would feel like, I'm not going to be all right now. And maybe a day or a half a day or 2 days later, I'd start to hurt again. And I always wanted to put a person, a place, or a thing on my wound. Now, when it came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, Dottie, we're going to have to tear your dirty bandages off. And they ripped them off, and they hurt. And they put a clean bandage on me called Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God, I started getting well from the inside out so that I am a total spiritual being, inside, outside, and all around me. I didn't say religious. I said spiritual. Spare me from religion. Spare me from churchianity. That does not mean that I don't go to a church that I've chosen. But like our Father John said last night, if he ever had a choice between his church and the program, and thank God we don't have to make that choice. But oh, I tell you truly, loved ones, if I had to take a choice between ever going to a church again or coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have to say goodbye to church. And you know why that's so great? I got God right with me no matter where I go. I don't have to go to a building to find him. Praise God for that. Praise God for that. You know, we can become a little too spiritual. We can become so heavenly-minded we're no earthly good if we're not careful. And that reminds me of a wonderful story. There's a man who died and went to heaven. And he got up to the gate at St. Peter. And he was welcomed, and he said, what religion did you have on earth? And the man kind of says, oh, dear, I'm in for it now. I didn't have any. Perfectly all right. He said, we're going to get in an elevator, and we're going to go up, and I'm going to show you all the religions, and you can take your pick up here. They go up the second floor, and it's the Catholics, and third floor is the Episcopalians, and fourth is the Baptists, and on up. Comes to the sixth floor, and he goes on past the seventh and up. The guy says, I still can't make up my mind. No problem, we have all the time in the world. Puts him in the elevator, starts bringing him back, names all the floors, and he comes to the sixth, and he says, and goes on down. The guy said, I'm still terribly confused. I don't know, you named all those religions. But he said, what happened when we got to the sixth floor? And he went, shh. Oh, he said, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you. That's a bunch from AA, and they think they're the only ones here, so we just don't name off their floor. You know, I thank God that AA is non-denominational. And we have no color, we have no creed, we have no prejudices. That's the agape love of Alcoholics Anonymous. We accept you, we love you, you're all our brothers and sisters. I feel closer to you than I do my own family. Because we are brothers and sisters in the Lord. And it's a wonderful feeling. I'm never alone. I never will be alone. I've had many joys in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had many sorrows. Now, the newcomers, we're not going to promise you you're going to get rich, nay. You're going to get any younger. I'm 28 years older. But I look 28 years younger today than I did when I came in here. And many things may not happen, and again it may, but don't come in here looking for goodies. Don't come in here thinking if I get sober, I'll get a husband or a wife, or I'll get rid of my husband and my wife. Come in here looking for the only thing we can offer you, the gift of sobriety, peace of mind, and a quiet heart. If you have those, you have everything. The scriptures tell me, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Now the kingdom of God is within me. His righteousness is simply his will for me. If I seek those two things first, all these things shall be added unto me. And I believe it. I believe every word that the AA book says, and I've come to believe every word that the scriptures say. If it isn't in the Bible and it isn't in the AA book, don't tell me about it. Don't give me your silly little cliches about this is a selfish program. Because selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of our problem. If you don't pull that up, the book says, selfishness will kill us. It may not kill you physically, but it'll kill you in relationships. It'll kill you in the group. It will kill you. There's no way of entirely getting rid of self without God's help. There's that word again, God. So if you get upset with the word spiritual or God, then have your sponsor stand with his hand over your shoulder and cover all the words in the book that says spiritual awakening, God as you understand him, because you're going to get upset. But you know something? If the word God upsets you, and you go out and get drunk, you've got the best excuse you ever found in the world to ever get drunk, and that's the word of God. I got drunk of a book of fingernail. I got drunk of a book with shoelace. So it makes no difference. The main thing is that this is a path we're going to walk. You never get to be an old-timer. If you do, you better watch out. Because every single day of my life, thank God, I have learned something new on this program. I learn from everyone I talk to. My baby, who's only 2.5 years old, is my teacher. She's fresh and new and not sedated with the jargon of Alcoholics Anonymous that I am. And she gives these things out to me, and I'm just totally amazed. Things that I knew and forgot. Oh, what a wonderful thing it is to give. As Father John said, you've got to give this thing out. You've got to give it out and into your cup and then fill it up. There's a song that says, Phil, here's my cup, Lord. Fill it up. Fill it up till I want no more. And the day that I will not want any more spiritual growth or any more love will be the day when I am totally out of this existence because it won't be necessary. I want to be teachable. I want to be loved. I believe that I'm insatiable. I will never have enough sobriety. I will never have enough acceptance. I will never have enough love, strokes, compliments, endearment. I am insatiable. And you feed me. Oh, thank God you feed me. You keep me full all the time. Now, many miracles have happened and many sad things. I'm going to take you quickly through some of the things that have happened since I've been sober. My talented, beautiful sister, who had everything going for her, died 3 years after I was sober as a result of alcoholic hemorrhages due to cirrhosis of the liver. She blew apart. Her stomach has swelled the size of a 9-month pregnancy. She's wearing dirty blue jeans and wandering the streets of Reno, Nevada, our hometown, like a bum. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and she pursued it to the gates of death and over. The last words she said on this physical plane were, Bill, I want a drink. I went home to a drunken Irish wake, and my mother got so drunk she fell off the chair. But before I left, a dear man, the name of Kim Coffey, I can break his anonymity, he's long since passed away. He came over and he was hopelessly crippled with arthritis. And he came to my house and he said, "Dottie, I want you to take a gift home to the funeral." And I said, "Fine." "You shouldn't have done it, because I knew you didn't have much money." He said, "It didn't cost a thing. Freely given to me, freely given to you. Take the serenity prayer home." And I said, "Oh, Ken, I know it." He said, "No, a little different way this time. You say, 'God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change today. Grant me the courage to change the things I can today, and the wisdom to know the difference today.'" And I went home for the first time, knowing what the serenity prayer meant. And when I got home and saw my sister in that casket, I thought, the script's wrong. Something's wrong. Young Dottie ought to be in there, and Edwin, the talented one, taking care of all this. And I'm saying, "God, I don't understand it." Through my mind, when a statement from the book, "We cease to fight everything and everybody, including alcohol." My sister fought everything and everybody, including alcohol, and died. I give up, and I won. And I came back to California, and my oldest daughter was into her addiction. Full-blown addict, alcoholic. Smashed her life away for 8 years. Came time that my grandson was a basket case. I had to finally take him from her. Hardest thing I've ever done. AA helped me. "You've always been there, you know. You've always been there." I had a meeting with an attorney, and they told me, "You're continuing to bring through this minor child, you've got to take him." And so I went and kidnapped him. And my daughter could have had me arrested for kidnapping. I spent, and I'll never forget this picture as long as I live to be 100, is Mary Poppins. I went into the Grauman's Chinese Theater, and I went up to about 4 or 5 showings of that show. Of course, my grandson loved every minute of it. And the next day, we went to court and got the guardianship papers filed. When we went to my daughter and presented her with the paper, she signed it so stern you couldn't read her writing. And when we left, she walked out of her apartment. She left her personal belongings and everything and disappeared off the face of this earth. As far as I was concerned, and you were there. You've always been there. Thank God, don't ever leave me. Well, I spoon-fed my grandson little bits of this AA program. He stopped sucking his thumb and wet in the bed. I didn't hear anything from her. And I thought I was doing pretty good, but then I picked up an emotionally induced illness called spastic colitis. That's chronic diarrhea, in case you don't know what that is. I went to the doctor. He said, "There's nothing physically wrong. You better go to a psychiatrist." And I'm sober, because after all, I'm 15 years sober now. You know, you tell me to go to a psychiatrist. I know everything, don't I? But I was working with an Episcopal priest's wife, and I loved Father Ken. He was a darling man. I went to him and I said, "Father Ken, what do you think's the matter with me?" He said, "I think you're in a panic. What are you afraid of?" I said, "I'm afraid Anne's going to die and I won't see her." And he said, "You must accept the fact that you'll have to die." And I said, "I can't." And he said, "Then go on fighting." And I said, the thought went through again, cease to fight everything and everybody, including alcohol. And the only fight I ever gave up was booze. So I went home and got down on my knees and I said something like this, "All right, Father, I'm sure you understand how this could be your will. But if indeed it's your will that Anne has to die, I surrender her to you even unto death. Just give me the strength to go through it." And the load fell off my shoulders. And that night I slept all night long for the first time in 8 months. And the next day at noon the phone rang and it was my daughter. If you call that a coincidence, that's a complicated way of spelling God. As we looked back on this day, she had been going into Mexico to get her drugs. You'd go into a drugstore there and buy 1,000 of anything you wanted. And she went in one day and the Hells Angels had been picked up going across the border and they closed it down. She went to her favorite drugstore in Tijuana and they didn't know what the hell she was talking about. She was tired and she was through. And it's not like you can go to another liquor store if one's closed. She came back into the United States, went to her apartment, closed the windows, blocked them with clothes, blocked the door, took the last overdose of drugs she had, turned the gas on, and laid down to die. And the very afternoon that I surrendered her to death was that afternoon, and they had turned the gas out that morning for lack of payment. Isn't that odd? That's God. Thank God my daughter's clean and sober 14 years on this program. She's married to an alcoholic, and they have a place called Turnoff down in Desert Hot Springs.
where they take care of young addicts, and they're doing one great job. After that happened, my husband and I were forced into bankruptcy. Now, I begged my husband not to go in business with this man. He was a practicing alcoholic, and my husband said, anybody that drinks too much, you think's an alcoholic. And I said, it takes one to know one. But trying to be a submissive wife, I let him go ahead. And we sold our house and took our savings account and went into business, and 9 months later, we're down the drain. Total bankruptcy. Walked out of the bankruptcy court with $7 from an old car and some furniture. I had a spiritual experience from bankruptcy. I know you'll think that's corny, but it's true. I stood in the shower that night with the hot water pouring on my back and thanked God for the first time in my life that I had a hot shower. I went to bed that night and thanked God I had a clean bed with sheets and a roof over my head. And I didn't know what we were going to do. Totally broke. Had nothing. It was so interesting, too. It's nice to have AA people around you. My AA attorney, I said to him, the only thing that I had that I really loved was a mink stole. And my husband had gone through great lengths to get this for me several years before. And I said, I'm going to sell that stole to my daughter for a dollar. He said, no, you aren't. This is an honest program. You're going to file it with everything else. If you're supposed to have that cape, you'll have it. If you're not, you'll have to accept it. I didn't like it, but I did it. And when the referee of the bankruptcy court started going down the list of assets, he came to the first stole and he said, kind of looked at me and he said, hell, we're not in the first selling business. Let her have it. And I got it. Every time I have surrendered and let go and gotten out of God's way, my miracles come. So many times I stand between God and my miracle. To get out of the way is the hardest thing, and I'm getting so I'm better now. I used to have to wait till my back was against the wall and then say, all right, and surrender, and then I won. As the years have gone by, I try not to do that anymore. I do for a little while, but not like I did then. Well, my grandson, my daughter's sober now, and I'm sending my grandson back to her. And because he comes from alcoholic stock, he was a full-blown addict and an alcoholic in less than 6 months. But you see, his mother and I are an attraction. And less than a year after his addiction, he called Alcoholics Anonymous. He's now sober 7 years on this program. So we have three generations on the program. Three generations. I come from a long line of neurotic, alcoholic, sick people. My youngest sister, my oldest sister died of alcoholism. My youngest one, 9 years younger, is drinking herself to death up in Northern California. And I'm sober. Why? I didn't take any smartening pills when I got here. I'm no different. I surrendered and I won. I threw in the towel. I hung up the boxing gloves and I got out of the fight ring. And I walked over and got in the lap of God. And I made it. Now, the trouble with finding a higher power is something we all have. We come in here, many of us thinking, yes, I have a higher power. Do you have your grandmother's higher power, your mother's higher power, or do you have your higher power? I have none. And I couldn't work the third step and turn my life and my will over to that crazy crackpot that was sitting upon that cloud, keeping books and going to kill me, and every time my kids got sick, going to kill them to punish me. I couldn't do it. And my sponsor says, you better find a new God. Well, that's like holding your breath for 45 minutes, you know. So I went to the people. Now, I was raised in a particularly religious, rigid church, and I was raised by an alcoholic minister, taught by a practicing alcoholic minister. I hope he made it someday, I don't know. And he used to make me say thee and thou. He used to make me kneel at a certain time, get up at a certain time. He'd snap this rubber band on his book, and we'd have to do it exactly. And I was terrorized. I didn't know the love of God. It was this man's idea. He must have been terrorized, too. That's why he had to drink. And it was awful. And so when I was very early, 16 years old, trying to get out of this impossible situation with my two sisters, I ran away and got married to a boy 17 years old. He didn't have a job, so we ended up with my mother. We didn't get very far that time. 2 months later, I was pregnant. And this kid didn't want the baby, and he wanted me to have an abortion. And he went around trying to borrow money from his boyfriends, and I was totally terrorized. Well, with a foundation like this, you know the marriage didn't last. And so I'm home, and this minister comes across my path, and he said, when are you going to have your baby baptized? And I said, not till I get married again. Oh, what a thing to say to him. He says, you can't marry again. If you do, you'll be living in adultery, and in the child that is shall be illegitimate. And in my self-will, I said, I'm going to get married again. And he said, you are excommunicated from the church. And if God had said, you're excommunicated, couldn't have been more official. God forgive that man, and I'm sure he has. And so I had no way of knowing how to find God. The very first person I talked to in Alcoholics Anonymous that night, I said to him, how do you believe in God? And he says, well, you mean my old man upstairs? Oh, my God, that's blasphemy. We're all going to get struck dead. So I'd listen to him. I'm going to say, how do you believe in God? He says, oh, you mean the old man upstairs? My old pal Joe? Oh, my God, you know. Some man came to me and he said, Dottie, you really want to know how to find God? And I said, oh, very much. He said, don't keep asking those people. You'll get those many answers. Not that they're wrong, but I can see what it's doing to you. He said, will you promise me that you'll pray one prayer for a whole week without any other prayer? I said, I'll do anything. He said, all right. You say, God, reveal yourself to me as you really are. And you start looking. Well, without exaggeration, I'll tell you, I prayed that prayer 100 to 1500, 200 times a day. God, reveal yourself to me as you really are. And you start looking. First thing I heard in the meeting was a man said, if you're having trouble finding God, take the word good and take one O out of it and you have God. Now I said, you go outside tomorrow and the sun is hot. You're not surprised. You don't say, gee, the sun's cold this morning. Why not? Because by its very being, the sun is a hot thing. So he says, God cannot be good and bad because by his very being, he's all good. Wow. I went home. The days go on. Still praying. Went to hear a man speak one night. Heard him 1,000 times, but he talked on something I'd never heard before. It's called the prodigal son. And he talked in kind of an AA jargon. He says, you know, once there was a young kid who decided he didn't want to wait for his old man to kick the bucket. So he went to him and claimed his inheritance, and the father gave it to him. And the kid got on a horse and went to a far country and spent his inheritance on wine, women, and song. He said, I think he was an alcoholic. And while he was in this deplorable state, he ended up totally bankrupt. There was a famine in the country. He went over to the pig sty, and he asked the man if he could tend the pigs. He said, yes, you can have all the corn husks that are left over. And he said, this boy was a Jew boy, and that's an awful place for a Jew to end up in the pig pen with the pigs eating corn husks. And while he was there in the deplorable state, he thought, I've lost the right to be a son, there's no doubt. I can be a servant, though, because my father gives me a clean bed of straw and something to eat. So he got up and he shuffled home to the father. Now he said, the father was out in the field working, and he looked way out there and he saw him. Far off, and he dropped what he was doing, and he ran to the son, and he put a cloak on his shoulder and a ring of acceptance on his finger. Now the kid tried to tell him all the rotten things he had done, but the father hushed him up. He didn't tell him to go out in the back 40 and cultivate the land for 30 days in penance. He said, it is enough that my son who was lost is now found. My son who was dead is now alive. And it was great celebration in the killing the fatted calf over one son who'd been lost and now returned. And on the way home from the meeting that night, I thought, surely to God, I'm a prodigal child. I'd come to you people and I'd claimed my inheritance, my pearl of great price, and I had thrown it away. And maybe instead of searching all out there for God, and I found out later he wasn't lost, looking out there for him, that if I shuffled up these steps to the very best of my ability, maybe the Father would see me a long way off, and maybe he would come to greet me. And you know that he did. As the day went on, this thing about a father was difficult. I had a dominating, matriarch mother and a faceless figure for a father. And I never had any father-daughter relationship, and so it was a little hard. And I was walking one day and praying and meditating, and the thought came to me of something I hadn't thought about in years. I was raised next door to a girl whose mother died when she was born, and her grandparents raised her. I was a hopelessly neglected child, and I used to be at her house more than I was home. And she had a grandfather she called Daddy Dick, and she had a grandmother she called Grandma Jo. And when I was over there, Daddy Dick would grab me and put me on his lap and lay my head on his shoulder, and he would say to me, you know, Dottie, if you ever need anything, just ask old Daddy Dick. God bless that man. And he did more for me than anybody had ever done. And my thought goes, maybe that successful old man with compassion and understanding who would say to a little girl, if you ever need anything, just ask Daddy Dick. Maybe, oh, maybe I could have a daddy God. Oh, maybe I could climb up in his lap and put my head on his shoulder. And he would say, you know, Dottie, if you ever need anything, just ask Daddy God. And I've had a daddy God since that day till this. He's magnificent. He's never mocked me, broken his word, showed favoritism, lied to me. He's closer than my breathing. Everybody out there, take a breath. How close he is. He's nearer than your hands and feet. How close is close? Now, the very last day, at the seventh day, when I'm praying the prayer, God, reveal yourself to me as you really are, and a daddy God comes into existence, I thought, is this too familiar? Am I being too friendly with God? When you say thee and thou all your life, you know, it's pretty hard to say, hey, Daddy God, I'm scared, but I can do that. And so my sponsor used to say, open any book or open the Bible and put your finger down when you're upset. So I thought, well, this is a spiritual thing. So I opened the Bible, put my finger down, and glory to God, I was to read these words. You who are human parents full of sin. If your children ask you for a piece of bread, would you give them a stone? If they ask you for a fish, would you give them a serpent? How much more, and listen, will your heavenly Father grant to those who believe in him? And it was like I had the package with a bow on it. And from that day on, I started to climb. Spiritual progress is my goal, the book tells me. Not to have this or that or money or property or prestige, but spiritual progress. And I never reached the goal, but the journey is magnificent. Since that day, I've become a born-again Christian. I always thought I was a Christian, but I'm a born-again Christian. And it's been a wonderful walk. He is nearer than my breathing. He is closer than my hands and feet. I can take him home. I can leave him here. We are never without him. We don't ever have to be without him. If he's not with you, make no mistake about it. You moved. He didn't. Thank God for that. Well, my husband went into total collapse after the bankruptcy. He didn't have a program like you and I, friends. He stared at the wall for 2 weeks, kind of a comatose state. I motivated him to go back to work, and he picked up an illness that is about as bad as ours, and even worse. He's become a compulsive worker and a compulsive sleeper. That's all he does, is run like 17 devils are after him and sleeps with his clothes on the couch all night long. And I lasted 8 years, and I loved him too long to hate him, and I had to walk away. Now, those are the things that have happened to me since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, but never once did it occur to me to have a drink, that it would be better. If I can't handle it sober, I can't handle it drunk. But most importantly, you were there. Don't you understand? You've always been there. You always will be here. Everything in this world can pass away, but AA and God's word will never pass away. It will always be here because it's divinely protected by him. Thank God. Now, I know I'm talking over time. I could talk to you for another 3 hours. I am so full of the glory of Alcoholics Anonymous that I could keep on talking forever and ever and ever. I love it so much. But the thing that is so wonderful about all this is that they told me a long time ago that what I planted, I would indeed reap. And the scriptures say, God will not be mocked. What a man planteth, therefore shall he reap. And we are taught not to expect anything in return, and that's good. But if you plant corn, you're going to go out there and see if that corn comes up. Now, if you want corn, you plant corn. If you want onions, you plant onions. But don't bitch and cry when you get onions. And what you plant on this physical plane with everybody you've ever given out to, you will reap the rewards of it. You will never have to worry about where it's coming from. If you help one human being in AA, when you are in need, someone will help you. You've planted the help, it'll always come back. By the same token, if you lie, you'll be lied to. If you cheat, you'll be cheated. If you steal, you'll be stolen from. And so I've done some planting in Alcoholics Anonymous, praise God. Not because I'm a better person than I used to be, but because you loved me and taught me. 3 years ago, I was presented with an anonymous paid trip to the Holy Land.
I can never thank anybody but God, so I don't know where it came from. But I walked the path that Jesus walked. And I saw where he was. And I was so filled that I can't tell you, I'll never be the same. I cried the whole time I was over there. I couldn't wear any makeup. I'm not emotional, you understand. It was simply wonderful. I've been granted many gifts. Many gifts. The greatest gift outside of sobriety, I think I've been added, was when I decided I didn't want to work in a pharmacy and pass out Valium and Librium. 9 out of every 10 prescriptions that I put across that counter were for Valium and Librium, and I couldn't stand it. And I wanted so badly to have plenty of time to work with my alcoholics, my people, my emotionally crippled people. And I started praying. And I thought, God, I don't know how I can do this. I'm thoroughly trained in pharmacy, but I don't have any education. And if it be your will, somehow show me what to do. And I went to Hawaii to a convention, and on the beach at Waikiki, I'll never forget it, I said, Lord, either take this desire from my heart or show me what to do. And I came back, and a girl called me, and she said, Dottie, there's a course being given at UCLA, and I think you ought to go. And I said, I only have 2 nickels to rub together. She said, please let me pay your tuition. You can pay me back. And I said, no, I cannot do that. And she said, no, but you'd do it for me. And I knew that I would. And so I worked 40 hours a week, and I went to school for 3 years at night. And I was always ready to quit. I'm basically a quitter in the wrong way. And I would pray, God, help me to go just one more semester. And so I finally walked out of there with my certificate. And 6 years ago, I became a counselor to emotionally induced illnesses. And I'm working with my people. I'm like Father John said, I get paid for my work, yes. But I'm a spiritual, emotional counselor. And the work and the things that God has used me to do is simply miraculous. I give him the glory, I give him the praise, because by myself, I am nothing. I tried to find a way to tell you how much I love you, what you mean to me. And God presented me with a poem written by George Eliot that answers it better than I can. And it goes like this. Oh, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of being safe with friends. Not having to weigh thoughts or measure words, but to pour it all out, chaff and grain together. Those friends who love you will take it and sift it. Keep what is worth keeping. And with a breath of kindness, they'll blow the rest away. Keep what I said, dear one, that is worth keeping. And with a breath of kindness, please blow the rest away. I love you. Thank you.